Hello, this is Jack Gare. I'm resident scholar at the American Bankruptcy Institute. We're here for another in a series of conversations with bankruptcy professionals in which we try better to understand the system and how they do their work in it. For this podcast, George Coffin brings to his bankruptcy practice a broad range of skills, including calligraphy and sailing. He's a lawyer who served also as a clerk of court, and he's one of a small handful of people who knows just about everything there is to know about pro bono programs in general, and especially pro bono programs in bankruptcy. George Coffin, welcome to ABI Podcast.
Thank you, Jack. Glad to be here.
George, let's get you situated first. You practice in South Carolina, right?
Right. I'm the head of the bankruptcy group at Nelson Mullins, Riley, and Scarborough. We have about 375 lawyers along the East Coast. I'm headquartered in Columbia, and about half of my practice is in South Carolina. The other half is out of state.
You're in Columbia, which is not Charleston, right?
Right, not Charleston. And people would rather always be in Charleston than Columbia.
Oh, is that right?
Oh, yeah. Especially in the summer. Columbia is about 10 degrees hotter than poor Charleston.
Okay. And out-of-staters have trouble telling them apart, I suppose.
They do, and they have problems keeping the Carolinas apart. I can't tell you how many cases I'm happy to receive from people that think North Carolina and South Carolina are the same. But
I grew up in New Hampshire, and people don't seem to understand that Vermont is upside down.
Right.
Same kind of problem, I guess. Are you a local boy down there? You got a bit of a Carolina accent, I think.
I was a military brat. My family's been here for hundreds of years, but I was born in New Orleans, and every 2 years, my dad would pick up and we'd move to a different port somewhere. Mm-hmm. So I've literally been all over the world. But yeah, this South Carolina is where Coffins normally call it home.
Did you go to university there in South Carolina?
I did. I went to the University of South Carolina for my undergraduate degree and for my law degree and for a master's in public administration. And then I worked on a master's degree in East Asian history that a famous bankruptcy case down here kept me from completing, the Sea Pines case.
Oh, my.
I found myself reading Asian history by flashlight, driving back and forth between Charleston and Columbia at night, and finished all the coursework, but could never start on the thesis because of the wonderful Sea Pines case.
Oh, my stars. Okay. But then you got out of law school, and what did you do when you got out of law school?
Well, I was clerking for a small creditor's practice that worked in North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia. So I worked for them for 5 years, and then I got a little bored with that. Decided I thought I need to learn a little bit more about the debtor practice and court administration. So I went to the bankruptcy court and became clerk of the bankruptcy court for South Carolina from 82 till 89.
Help me on location there. Were you in Columbia at that point?
Columbia, and this state is a one district state. So, we covered the entire state, and we had some interesting cases then. We had the Sea Pines bankruptcy, and then we had the PTL bankruptcy. Jim and Tammy. I met both of them, and she did wear as much makeup as everybody's heard. And got into some disputes with Reverend Falwell, and it was an interesting case.
What impelled you to go into the clerk's office?
Well,
not that I want to disdain it. It just sounds like awfully hard work.
It did seem like it would be a challenge, and I was getting a little bored with my creditor practice. But I thought it would be a good place to learn. We had a wonderful judge J. Bratton Davis, who was the consummate gentleman. And so I think it was good for my learning curve, but also it was very good to try to calm me down and make me a little bit more temperate working with Judge Davis.
Okay. And did you manage clerk's offices then in Columbia and Charleston?
Yeah, for the entire state. We have court in Charleston, Columbia, and Spartanburg, so I managed it for all three. And one thing that was a little bit unique about that time, we didn't have the U.S. trustee until 1987. So when I saw what I thought was abuse in the system, I basically gave myself standing. And I would bring motions to everything to appoint a trustee to disqualify or disbar lawyers in this court. And so I averaged about 3 to 5 motions like that per week.
Per week?
Per week.
What you going to say per year?
Mm-mm. Oh, no. And it kept things interesting for me. But also, I think it kept us from having a lot of Deadwood 11s and abusive lawyers and other issues.
Did they ever take you up on that? Do you have any word from the circuit on whether it was proper?
One person appealed it to the district court, and the district court said, of course, you know, the clerk's office has some obligation to maintain this. And, of course, we had – that was the old state administrator program where we were already doing fee reviews. So it wasn't too much of a step to get into, you know, performing a lot of the dues at the U.S. Trustee's office. We always like to say that our clerk's office did it with 1.5 people, whereas the U.S. Trustee's office would need 10 or more to do the same thing. It's because of all those reports they do.
I guess there's always a feeling among judges that they must have some kind of inherent authority to run their court, no matter what the statute says.
Well, but I did this independent of the judge. I wouldn't take direction from the judge because he felt like he had to be the adjudicator, so he would leave it to me to bring the particular motion. And candidly, that's one of the reasons I got involved with pro bono. I'd been a pro bono volunteer when I was in private practice, and because of that, I joined a state bar committee called the Service to Indigents Committee. And when I got to the bankruptcy court, when I would see pro se people come in, I would always feel so helpless and sorry that they were coming to bankruptcy court to get something designed for people that were poor, designed for indigents.
Yeah. Look, I certainly want to talk about that. I think it's our main reason for being here today, but help me a little more with the context here.
Sure.
So you're doing this clerk's work, and you're acting as kind of you're taking some initiative in the clerk's work. I gather you also did some mediation in those days. Right?
I did. The judge, I think I mentioned we had the highest caseload at one point. So our bankruptcy judge, frequently when he had a really complex case or a case that was going to take a couple of days, he would ask me to try to mediate it. And so we had a spare courtroom for a visiting judge, and he would ask me to take them down the hall, and we'd sit there and try to hash it out. And I'd share with them unreported cases that some of the out-of-state people might not be aware of.
Okay.
And I actually had some pretty good luck on being an in-house mediator.
I guess, well, the judge doesn't have another judge down the hall he can slough it off on. But you were a lawyer at that point, weren't you?
I was a lawyer, and it had a pretty sizable creditor practice, so I knew the law fairly well. And most of the South Carolina lawyers, all the South Carolina bankruptcy lawyers knew me, and I got along pretty well with the out-of-state guys, too.
But you did this for what, you say, half a dozen years?
Did it for 7 years, and I'd given notice to the judge probably at year number 4 or 5 that at the end of the decade I wanted to go sailing for a year. And nobody believed it, but I think 7 years, I think actually 5 years is long enough to be clerk of court, because I think it helps for someone to transit between private practice and court administration to stay in touch with, you know, what private practice people have to go through.
So, and did you go sailing?
I did. My wife and I, we both quit, and we got so anxious to go, we actually moved the calendar up about 6 months, and I had to get permission from the district court, because I was sitting as the district court judge's in-house bankruptcy lawyer for him. One of our judges took over the Seapines case, and every time he held court, he would ask me to sit there with him. So I was mediator, litigator, and basically assistant law clerk.
Not to get too far distracted, but we stipulated before that Columbia is not Charleston. Columbia is a long walk from the beach. How did you practice all the sailing?
It's 2 hours from Charleston, but I kept my boat in Charleston. So when I had court down there on the Seapines case, I would spend the night on the boat, which it had a little space heater. But I got to tell you, Jack, January, walking down the pier with a bank box of files you have to go over, research for the next morning, and it's 10 o'clock at night and the wind's blowing, you kind of think, boy, I wish I were in a hotel. But, yeah, I got time like that. And, frankly, I used the sailboat for some of the mediation things. Every time I used that sailboat in a mediation case to serve as a mediator, I was able to settle a case except for one tax lawyer from the U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington, and she knows who she is. I knew when she joined Cap Vavir we weren't going to settle this case. But every other case that I used the boat for a mediation platform, settled.
Somebody once told me that one of the rules of life is you never accept a deal proposed on somebody else's yacht.
Well, I had one person just absolutely refuse to meet on the boat because he knew what was going to happen.
So you went sailing for a year, and
yep.
Then you came back, and what, back in law practice then?
I came to work at this law firm I'm at now, Nelson Mullins, and I've been here for, I guess this will be 16th year.
You do, you say, bankruptcy practice there?
That's all we do for a living is post basically creditor work on business cases. And we will do the occasional debtor case when we can get by the conflicts, but that's pretty rare.
I see. Now let's talk about pro bono.
Sure.
You said you started doing pro bono work when you were a young lawyer, right?
When I first started practicing, my family basically drilled into me a public service. My mother required me to be a lifeguard and teach swimming for about 5 years when I was living at home. So I taught swimming. They had me in the Boy Scouts. And so I felt just inclined to look for some kind of public interest, public service work to do when I became a lawyer. I went to legal services and said, I'm in private practice, but I'll be happy to take some freebie cases from you. And that's back when Judicare was in full-fledged, and they said, well, that's great. If you'll take two paying cases, we'll give you one free one. And I said, no, I'd like to do just free ones. And we had a big fight about that, so I never ended up doing referral work from legal services. I went to the court, and they would send me referral cases. But then when I got to the clerk's office, it felt really bad to see people walk up to the intake desk to file their own cases, and that was back in the days before it was as complex as it is today.
And not to distract you, but I guess something nationwide, we got like 30-35% of all bankruptcy cases filed by debtors pro se, I guess.
It's a pretty high number, and it varies from district to district. I know California Central was as high as 40 at one point, and other districts, we were at 1%. I think we're at 3% in South Carolina now, which I'm... I've got it per se, which I'm embarrassed to have it at 3. We had been at 1 for a long time.
So this is great. Let's nail that. We've got a nationwide average of about 30% pro se, mm-hmm. and you in South Carolina have about 1, 2, 3% pro se.
We had 1% for years. I mean, we started our program in 86.
Okay.
And
Tell us how you get from A to Z on that one. How do you get from 30% to 1%?
Well, Jack, as I mentioned, we have people coming in the door trying to file their own cases. I remember one case that just tear your heart out. This guy was selling his own blood for the filing fees, to try to raise money for the filing fee. They would never understand lien avoidances. They never understood exemptions. These things just, it might work as a 7, but they never worked as a 13. So I started a panel by going to some of the best consumer lawyers that we had practicing in the court. And I felt a little apprehensive about being the clerk of court who sometimes brought motions asking them to do volunteer work, but if anyone showed any reluctance, I didn't push it. But I found that when you asked one-on-one, most lawyers were eager to do it. And the best volunteers that we had were the debtor consumer bar. So we started that in 86 on a parallel track on that state bar committee. We were starting to develop a statewide pro bono program. So that got launched in 87, and then I merged my little panel with the state bar's panel.
Am I getting this clear? You had a pro bono operation going in the bankruptcy court, and you talk about the state bar's operation. Is this a state bar bankruptcy operation or a state bar pro bono in general operation?
It's a state bar pro bono in general. I think I mentioned I've got a master's degree in public administration. One of the courses was to write a grant for a grants course. And so I wrote one to create a pro bono program, a statewide pro bono program, and I sent that to the ABA after the state bar blessed it, and the ABA liked it. They funded their first statewide pro bono grant, and that program's now been in, next year it'll be 20 years that it's been running. And
so the ABA funded your...
The first year.
Your grant that you wrote as a class proposal.
Right.
And what kind of grade did you get?
Well, my professor wrote on an A-. This proposal is not very practical. I did not tell him that at the time I was giving it to him for a grade, I was also submitting it to the ABA. But later, years later, when I'd see that professor and I told him what the ABA had done, he admitted, well, maybe he sometimes makes mistakes.
So he told you it wouldn't fly, and it did fly.
It wouldn't fly, but it did fly. So
okay,
I was real pleased with that.
What's your state program do?
The state program takes referrals from legal services. So legal services will screen every indigent that comes to them for a case. And if they, if it's not one of their priorities, legal services will send it to the statewide pro bono program, which things they do not handle, legal services does not handle Chapter 7 bankruptcies. They just won't handle them.
So not at all.
Not at all. And they only do 13s when it impacts somebody's house.
Uh-huh.
So they'll send all those to the state bar program. The state bar program then has a list of pro bono volunteers. What they do is they take the names of the creditors of the debtor, and they'll say, I've got debtor X from Timmonsville, South Carolina. They won't give their real name. And here are the creditors. And they'll send that by fax or by email to the next volunteer on the list. And if that volunteer doesn't have a conflict, they'll make the assignment to that particular person. Now, we're lucky in South Carolina because it's such a small state. And we've only got court in three locations, so it's pretty easy to cover the rural parts of the state this way if the debtor's willing to travel. So it's not, you know, it would be hard to do a statewide pro bono program in a state like Florida where it's so large, or a state like North Carolina where it takes 13 hours to go from Asheville to the Outer Banks.
13 hours, yeah.
But South Carolina, I can travel from one end to the other in 4 to 5 hours. And so... We're pretty willing to, I'm willing to do cases where the debtor lives 100 miles away, and it works out pretty well. But so they'll make that referral, and then we keep the paperwork to a very bare minimum. The incoming intake paperwork from legal services comes with the package, and then there's a postcard at the end saying that you send to the bar saying the case is completed, or they never showed up for the appointment, or we came up with another alternative, and I spent X amount of hours. And then it's finished. In return, we give them malpractice coverage for their pro bono case through the National Legal Aid and Defenders Association, so they're covered for malpractice.
Okay. Yeah, that was on my list. Okay.
That's covered. If they come into some kind of complex legal issue, there is a pro bono program at the University of South Carolina, and in the past, they've been willing to do some research on things like that, especially for sole practitioners. But then we've got people like Johnny Butler, who's a well-known in South Carolina publisher on bankruptcy issues. He publishes a bankruptcy handbook. He's written about a half dozen law review articles. Johnny's happy to assist on complex pro bono cases on the research side as well. So we've got a good little network of people willing to help out.
We'll be back after a short break.
We pause this week's podcast to bring you bankruptcy in the news. Large international bankruptcies were in the spotlight as Russian oil company OAO Yukos proposed its outline for a restructuring plan, and Italian food conglomerate Parmalat looked for continued U.S. protection from its creditors. Facing more than $29.5 billion in claims and possible liquidation in a Russian bankruptcy court, Yukos proposed an outline for a restructuring plan with the U.S. Bankruptcy Court in the Southern District of New York. Its proposal looks for core assets to be left intact while creating a cash pool separate from the company to pay out its creditors. Yukos filed for Chapter 15 bankruptcy on April 15th. Parmalat received a 4-month extension of a U.S. court protection order against its creditors. The company announced that the temporary protective order was pushed back to September 12th. An Italian court also opened criminal proceedings this week against 64 former Parmalat executives, financial advisors, and bankers facing charges for the company's collapse in 2003. Dubbed Europe's Enron, the food company's bankruptcy was due to accounting fraud that resulted in a loss of 14 billion euros, which equates to $17.9 billion. This has been John Hartgen of the ABI. Thank you for listening, and now back to this week's podcast.
Tell me about identifying cases now. I know one thing that's distinctive about South Carolina, aside from 1% pro se, is that you've got perhaps the highest Chapter 13 percentage in the country, don't you?
It's one of the highest 13 ratios in the country, but we're also the lowest for filings per household. I think Utah is one of the highest things where households are filing. We're one of the lowest. We are the lowest. But 13s have traditionally been a southern thing. Birmingham, Alabama, I think, was the home of the Chapter 13. In North Carolina, they kind of fine-tuned it. North Carolina is the one that gave us Chapter 12, which is a spinoff of Chapter 13. In fact, this whole debtor education thing, Judge Rufus Reynolds in the Middle District of North Carolina required an education program for all of his 13 debtors back in the 80s and 90s.
Did he perfect it?
Yeah. I mean, you couldn't get your discharge without going through an education program in the Middle District of North Carolina. So some of these things are, you know, you see them coming around again.
But how do you identify clients for the for the pro bono program here, in particular in the case where you're farming most of these, or a great many of these cases out to people who do this stuff for a living?
The beauty of it is legal services will do the screening, and legal services clients in South Carolina are at a 125% of the federal poverty guideline. And so right now, the median income, say for a family of four in South Carolina, the median income is something like $25,000. Well, 125% of the federal poverty guideline for a family of four is like $14,000 or $15,000. So you can see where when you look at the means test, you'll never have to go through the means test with a pro bono case from the South Carolina Bar, because the people are usually making less, about half of what the median income is. So they screen them. They do a good job of screening them. You get the package from them, and it's almost, not quite, but almost enough to complete the schedules and statements with. Bring them in for an interview. What I like to do is to get a credit bureau report on each of the debtors that I do, because I find that most people forget some of the old debts that have not been active for a while. And then run them through. And like I say, all we do in our pro bono program is sevens. We have the authority from the bar that if we feel like they can do a 13 and it's in their best interest, we have the authority to make an exception and do a 13. And I do know a few exceptions where, you know, they've either gotten a better job during the case and they've converted over, or they started off as a 13.
So tell me a little more detail. Who are the lawyers that do these things?
Well, it up until October 17th, it was a broad range of our bankruptcy bar here. We have about 600 lawyers that are active bankruptcy lawyers in South Carolina. And probably about 100 of them were pretty good pro bono volunteers. We have big firm, small firm, creditor, consumer. Now, unfortunately, because of the uncertainty about the debt relief agency label, most of the big firms, except our firm, have withdrawn from the statewide pro bono program. Even though our U.S. Trustee's office has been good about saying we don't think a pro bono volunteer is getting compensation that would label them as a debt relief agency. So our U.S. Trustee has been good about trying to support this. Our Chief Judge, Judge Waits, has been good about trying to encourage people to stay active with pro bono. But we have admittedly had a drop. Now, the good news is our debtor bar that do the volume filings, we've always had one or two volunteers each year who've told the pro bono program, when you run out of volunteers, don't turn anybody away. Send the leftovers that you can't place to me. And so as a result, we always have one of our debtor firms who does 30 or 40 or 50 pro bonos each year, which we would be dead without that cooperation. But frankly, I think they like our program because we never do 13s. We always figure a 13 could be revenue generating. And so we try to be sensitive to their needs as well.
Tell me a little bit about a debt relief agency requirement. Is it this standard reading in South Carolina that attorneys are debt relief agencies?
Well, it works like this under the code, that if you are doing consumer cases, and the dollar limit is something like if the particular debtor's case has non-exempt value of $150,000, then you then you could be deemed a debt relief agency, which is...
Well, I guess all I mean is, are your consumer bankruptcy attorneys in general registering as debt relief agents?
Yeah, I think they are. They are because they pretty much have to. Some firms, like our firm, have always had a policy that we're not going to take consumer debtor cases, individual cases. We're just not set up to do those. We represent mostly creditors.
Of course, there are people that are taking the view that even if you represent creditors, you may find yourself giving the kind of advice that makes you a debt relief agency.
Right.
I guess that hasn't been your view yet, I take it.
No.
Okay. Do you have a view yourself? Was it Congress's intent that attorneys be debt relief agencies?
I don't
think it's an accident.
I don't think they intended that, and we've got that wonderful decision from the Southern District of Georgia where one of the bankruptcy judges early on has said that he doesn't think that that's the intention. But I will tell you, I've got probably a number of volunteers in this district that are waiting for some ruling one way or the other before they come back to the program.
I see. Okay. So it's impacted the number of lawyers who keep involved here.
It has, and I can't blame them. There are so many different pro bono opportunities out there. I mean, if somebody's inclined to do pro bono, why not work in a practice area like children's rights where there's no conflict about screwing over your firm on an advertising thing?
Okay.
You know?
Then the first time I talked to you a few weeks back, you were on your way to New Orleans, right?
Right. Jim Bailey, who's been with the American Bar Association pro bono program for years, he's with Byron Fredrickson up in Minneapolis. Jim's done a lot in pro bono over the years. Jim and I both are on the American College of Bankruptcy pro bono committee. And Jim, bless his heart, was going to spend his vacation in New Orleans trying to work on a pro bono bankruptcy program down there to help try to use out-of-state lawyers to assist the New Orleanians on bankruptcy cases. And so he knew I was from New Orleans. He mentioned that he was going down there, and he said
Oh, you are, aren't you?
Yeah, but I was born there. So he welcomed my participation. And so we went down there and spent a nice week just before Jazz Fest. And I think, I mean, Lord, if you've looked at the papers this week, you can see where a lot of government entities in New Orleans are even looking at Chapter 9.
Tell me what you're able to do down there.
Well, we met. New Orleans is lucky because they've had in place for about over 15 years a really strong pro bono project with a good director and a good pool of volunteers and a great board. So they had the infrastructure to begin with, which was nice. They have not been able to deal with all their pro bono bankruptcy cases over the years. So we basically met with some big firm guys and tried to encourage them to participate. We also worked with Brad Boats, who is the executive director of the National Association of Consumer Bankruptcy Attorneys. They are, in fact, having their annual conference in New Orleans this weekend, and they're putting together a bankruptcy pro bono clinic for a lot of the locals. But Brad's group met with Jim and I, and he flew down from Birmingham, and we met together and tried to come up with some ideas to help this. Now, one of the ideas that we've already implemented, the American College of Bankruptcy gave a grant after our week-long meeting down there for about $1,000 to the pro bono project, and that's to be used for registration fees for volunteers who agree to take 5 pro bono cases in return for attending the National Association of Consumer Bankruptcy Attorneys seminars this coming weekend. So here's the pitch they're making to locals. If you wanted to become a bankruptcy lawyer, you can take the course for consumer bankruptcy lawyer this weekend from the NACBA. And if you commit to taking 5 pro bono cases, we'll pay your registration fee. And that's been very popular. So we've already started implementing that. We've got some other ideas that we're looking at. And they need a lot of help there. And I think they're going to have a big surge in filings when the insurance money runs out. So,
have you been involved in setting up pro bono programs elsewhere?
Yeah, I've been on some American Bar Association peer consulting groups where I've worked in Maryland, Mobile, and Northern Virginia on pro bono programs in general, not necessarily bankruptcy pro bono programs. Jim Bailey and I, along with Judge Nancy Dreher, Robert Milner, some others, worked with the ABA back in the 80s to set up a booklet called the How to Begin a Pro Bono Program in Your Bankruptcy Court, a starter kit for lawyers and judges. And that was recently updated by Jim Bailey, and that's available online from the ABA. And it's a great manual for somebody that's interested in starting a pro bono program in their own court. I've also been involved in the American College of Bankruptcy's pro bono committee since, gosh, that may be 10 years too.
It's a while, huh?
Yeah. And the college, I just love the college. Every time I go and ask for money to increase our pro bono grants, they give me more than I ask for. So it makes me wonder if I'm asking for not enough, but
bad operant conditioning, isn't it?
But I always try to be reasonable, but they've been very, very good about giving out money to encourage other groups to start pro bono bankruptcy programs in their states. And so far, I think we've given grants to 28 different states to start this. So, you know, the college has been good about trying to promote this as well.
Wayne Coffin, it sounds like you put a lot of work into that. You get some satisfaction out of it. It sounds like you put a lot of work into it, too.
Jack, I have to tell you, my corporate clients, I'll get a nice note sometimes or a nice handshake, but when you get a big hug from a pro bono Chapter 7 woman who's been harassed by her creditors and who's thinking about suicide, that means so much more than, I mean, I've got to have the fees paid on the billable clients, but it's so gratifying to get that hug from a pro bono client. You just, nothing can replace that.
You're a hardworking guy. Is it time to go sailing again?
Well, in about 3 weeks, I'll be in the Bay of Naples sailing on a 37-foot sailboat. So, ready to go. I've already got my charts out. So.
Well, it sounds to me like maybe you've earned it.
I think it's time.
Well, George Coffin, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Jack. Enjoyed this.
You've been listening to one of a series of podcasts that we are producing here at the American Bankruptcy Institute to help us all understand better how bankruptcy professionals do their work. We hope you found it helpful. Look on our webpage at abiworld.org for more podcast choices. This is Jack here saying thank you for listening.